And we are back for another episode of Conversing Labs podcast. I'm your host, Paul Roberts, the cyber content lead here at Reversing Labs. I am really pleased to have with us today Dr. Kevin Fu of Northeastern University and the Archimedes Center for Medical Device Research. Kevin, welcome back. I think we've talked before. I don't know if we've had you on Conversing Labs before.
Yeah, it's great to be back. Always appreciate your thoughtful questions, Paul.
Thank you. And you're not at Northeastern right now. You're actually down in Washington, D.C. Tell us what you're up to.
Today, there's an event at FDD, and they're hosting a special webinar with Jen Easterly and other principals on the PCAST report about how to build resilience into cyber-physical systems that are critical infrastructure of the nation, the 16 critical infrastructures as defined by CISA.
This is a really big focus of CISA right now on kind of building security and trying to change culture in many ways across these areas. You're there because obviously medical devices and healthcare are one of those 16 critical areas.
And change is both technical and cultural, as you point out. Engineering is relatively easy. We have consensus bodies, formal methods for getting the standards going. But on culture change, that requires leadership execution. And that's what we'll be talking about today, the panel on the PCAST report.
So very cool. Talk about your journey into medical device security, because you actually started working in a hospital very early in your career, and that inspired you.
That's right. I started working in healthcare around 1993 or so, a small community hospital in Holland, Michigan, and I was the gopher of the room. At night, I would have a beeper, and if something would go wrong, such as a clinician losing their authentication tokens, they'd come down with me to get a new set of tokens. And it was a really good experience and opportunity and eye-opening, because I realized just how complicated the security story would be because of the human factors involved. And because the mission for patient care is just very different from, say, logging into your cloud email. There's a lot more at stake.
So you started the Archimedes Center when you were at the University of Michigan. And before that, you started your career at the University of Massachusetts, focused very early on the cybersecurity of medical devices. Talk about, first of all, the research that you do at Archimedes with your students and the types of problems you focus on and devices. And also just give us a sense of like how that work has evolved over the last 10 or 15 years. Because you were in early. You were really one of the first people really looking hard at this question.
Right. To answer your last question first, what sort of evolved since then? We started around 2007 with some early research on pacemaker security, and that was at UMass Amherst in Western Massachusetts. And that evolved over time to more public policy with Archimedes, Michigan, and now Northeastern. I would say the biggest change, if you take a look at some of our writing from 15 years ago, we would talk about risks to healthcare from cybersecurity threats. And the response was, that's very hypothetical. And today, healthcare organizations paying $22 million because of cyber threats with ransom. Since we did not predict ransomware, but we did predict malware. Of course, the instantiation is perhaps stranger than fiction, right? It's really changed from theoretical to actual risks with actual adversaries who are usually economically motivated or motivated politically. But 15 years ago, I would say we were shifting from worrying more about, you know, the bored kid in their basement breaking in to hospitals. And now we've really shifted to sophisticated organizations and threat actors.
And of course, as we're speaking today, we're in the midst of a huge crisis in the healthcare space with the hack of United Healthcare, which owns a company that basically facilitates a lot of the billing that hospitals and doctors' offices do so they can get paid for their services, subject of a ransomware attack, the Lockbit Group, which a few weeks ago we were saying had been taken out by U.S. authorities. And then they reminded us that they hadn't. I'm understanding this. This is a new ransomware attacks have affected healthcare organizations. What's a bigger story behind an incident like the one at United?
I think the bigger story is not necessarily what's happening right now in this very week, which is quite concerning because of so many weeks of downtime affecting such a large percentage of all Medicare reimbursable procedures. But I think the bigger story is this is just one big company. And there are dozens, if not hundreds, of other single points of failure that really cut to the main problem of how do we be resilient? Even if the cloud goes down, how do we be resilient even if an adversary breaks through a series of firewalls. And through engineering and the classes that many faculty teach, we know it's possible to build a resilient system, even if an adversary sits on the network and controls it. I have to say, today, most products I see don't build their systems under that threat model. And so I think the bigger question is, how can we get away from reporting on these incidents and get more toward engineering and building in the security by design that we already know how to do, but have not chosen to do so? How do we get that out into the marketplace and incentivize it?
This is a conversation that's happening across our $22 trillion economy, right? But in the healthcare space, in the medical device space, there's actually some progress that's been made, so certainly some reason for optimism. There's the passage of the Patch Act, which is one of the most kind of toothy, substantial cybersecurity federal regulations regarding medical devices. And then, as you noted on LinkedIn, the Biden proposed federal 2025 budget contains quite a bit of money, more than $1 billion, focused just on cybersecurity for healthcare environments. That's a proposed budget, not a past budget, so we don't know. But where should some of that money be spent in your mind? And when we look at the Patch Act, have we seen a practical impact in terms of increased cybersecurity levels as a result of the passage of that?
Let me first talk about the Patch Act, and then we can get into this new proposed $1.3 billion budget to incentivize cybersecurity practices at healthcare delivery organizations. So the Patch Act was introduced and proposed by Representative Burgess. He is a physician from Texas. And that act required, for instance, the submission of a software bill of materials, among what I would consider just basic hygiene. But it really raised the bar from voluntary recommended practices that FDA would introduce. So in other words, it's a law. So a law is much stronger than an office's guidance documents or recommendations to manufacturers. The Patch Act eventually became part of the language you'll find inside the omnibus bill of last year. Just yesterday, FDA published guidance on how it's implementing the 524B requirements. That the 524B requirements, if you look at the language, really derives from that proposed Patch Act legislation.
One of the notable features of the Patch Act was this requirement around software bills of materials for medical devices that manufacturers are expected now to provide. Again, part of a larger conversation that is bigger than just the medical device space. Has that had an impact? And are we seeing delivery on that requirement? And if so, have we learned anything after looking at some of these SBOMs?
I would say the jury's still out. I'm very optimistic, but the finalized guidance from FDA that discusses the type of contents of software bill of materials that it would like to see in its pre-market submissions was only released last year. So a lot of these things are still working its way through the marketplace. FDA only recently opened what's called eSTAR, their new electronic submission system for manufacturers who submit their, what I would consider sort of term projects, basically the design documentation on why their devices are safe and effective. They now have a cybersecurity component to this submission process. I'm optimistic, but I think it's going to take at least a year, if not years, to really know more about the outcomes or even know about some of the numbers of, for instance, how many pre-market submissions were desk rejected for just forgetting to include a cybersecurity case, which I suspect will be growing. Or when FDA reviewers are looking at the quality of the threat modeling or some of the risk mitigations, to what degree do they accept the manufacturer's decisions or push back saying, we need you to modify this and then send us an update and then we'll reconsider.
One of the interesting things in the medical device space is you have this regulator, the FDA, that actually has a gatekeeper role that can keep products off the market if they don't meet the standards that they set. And as we talked about with the Patch Act, cybersecurity becomes a much bigger part of that bar that you've got to clear. But of course, there are also just the consumers, the healthcare organizations that end up buying and deploying this technology. Is it your sense that they're attuned to these problems? Or is it, hey, once you get past the FDA, once you're cleared to get on the market, people are just going to take it at face value that you've got adequate cybersecurity? Or are you seeing kind of hospitals, healthcare organizations starting to look hard at issues like what's in that SBOM? And is our procurement going to be influenced by what's in that SBOM, for example?
I think you'll find different answers depending upon the type of organizations. There are some healthcare systems that are leading the way and leading things related to SBOM development, as well as the effective use of an SBOM. I can certainly just hand you an SBOM and you might say, what do I do with this? You could choose to ignore it as a healthcare delivery organization. You could choose a third-party provider to essentially write you cliff notes to tell you, is this a good SBOM? Or at the end of the day, it's all about risk management. And so it's all about accepting risk and then understanding what are some of your weaknesses that you may need to spend a little bit more observation time on just in case something goes wrong in what we call the post-market. Now, with FDA serving as this role of clearing or approving devices into the US market, that's not a get out of jail free card. What's that saying? You've met our bar of safety and effective, as well as for the case of cybersecurity, the statutory requirements from that 524B section. Things can still go wrong in the post-market. And there's an entire second set of processes for what happens when there's a vulnerability that then affects a medical device or, more concerning, an actual incident. So you can have a near miss, like a vulnerability, you know something could go wrong, but there are also several documented cases of actual harm happening where a medical device is compromised, and then there needs to be a post-market action. Typically, this involves what's known as a recall, and there's a whole set of language that I'm surprised a lot of manufacturers are not aware of. Their general counsels, if they don't know about this, they need to go probably take some of the classes we offer at Archimedes. But it talks about the basic requirements of, it's called the 803 exemption. So there's a certain set of criteria where if you meet it, FDA exercises its discretion, its enforcement discretion, and you basically have an easier time as a manufacturer. One of the requirements, for instance, is giving notice within a certain number of days once you discover this vulnerability to, for instance, some of the affected entities in the healthcare community. There are other criteria to meet that exemption. But that's there as an incentive system to encourage the manufacturing community to be more transparent about these vulnerabilities so that the healthcare organizations, hospitals, for instance, small clinics, at least have a chance to take some action before any harm happens to patients. And harm can take many forms. Harm can be delaying of patient care. Harm can be unavailability to deliver patient care, right, as we're seeing in the case of ransomware hitting healthcare organizations.
Right. That is what is so distinctive about this particular vertical, this sector. You are literally talking about life and death. You're not just talking about availability. You're not talking about economic damage. You're talking about people potentially not being able to get life-saving treatment when they need it. And there are no stakes higher than that. And yes, this transparency issue is a really big one. We see that with the analysis of the Avanti Pulse VPN. Turned out it was running really old open source code and had vulnerabilities and was exploited by Chinese actors and so on. In your research right now, what are you seeing as the main kinds of risks or threats that organizations face with regard to medical devices? Because hospitals and stuff, they all have IT infrastructure just like any other organization. That's typically what's being targeted by ransomware groups and stuff like that. But when we look specifically at medical devices, what do you see as the biggest threats that are out there?
There are a couple ways you could interpret this. I think there's looking at risk, there's actual risk, what's at stake, and then there's more decisional risk. What are we doing that we ought to be doing differently as a defender? On that note, I think one of the big risks organizationally is thinking about these problems through the IT lens rather than the OT lens. So OT, it's operational technology. These tend to be kinetic things, cyber physical, things like factory floors, autonomous vehicles, medical devices. We have a large group of people who are very well trained in IT security. But guess what? Some of the things that you're taught are the right approaches in IT security are the exact wrong approaches for OT security. Let me give you one example. In IT security, we think isolate. We think if there's an infection, we shut the system down or we disconnect it. That's not what you do for an OT system. For an OT system, what matters is continuity of operations and high availability. And so you would make different choices. You want to make sure that patient care continues to be highly available, even if ransomware gets in. And so the question is, how do we design and architect these systems to be resilient, even if ransomware gets into a system such that it's self-containing rather than having to just pull the plug on an entire country? So that's one of the more organizational risks. And I think it's difficult to predict threats and risks. So 10 years ago, we were predicting malware would be a big problem. We were seeing a lot of malware breaking into hospitals simply because hospitals had old legacy software. You could actually find Windows XP still on MRI machines. And I would not be surprised if you find some out there today. By the way, at Archimedes, we're going to be hosting a jazz funeral procession for Windows 10. Windows 10 is going out of support.
I love it.
We want to draw attention to this.
When is this? We got to be there.
Oh, you got to. It's going to be May 1 and 2 in New Orleans. And so the jazz band will be marching down the street, holding signs, drawing attention to goodbye, Windows 10. Thank you for your service. And it's time to patch. It's time to update because you want to know what healthcare systems are going to get hit with the next ransomware and $22 million ransoms? It's the ones running the outdated software that's not only insecure, but insecurable because they no longer will have security patches.
Right.
So one of the biggest risks is really basic hygiene stuff that engineers will go, why are we even talking about this? Of course you need to do that. Of course you need to patch your software. Of course you need a threat model. But there's a large part of the healthcare infrastructure that simply hasn't done what I would consider the pre-lab. Before you're allowed into the classroom to do an experiment, you actually have to do the basic homework, understand what assets are at risk, before you can even begin to ask the question, what do we do about it? And you'll see some of these in the HHS cyber performance goals. It even has an acronym, of course, because it's government, CPGs. But you'll see elements of this, I think, being socialized from these cyber performance goals at HHS.
You mentioned that Archimedes does training for IT folks who work in healthcare. What types of things, what types of training do you offer and what types of problems do you try and orient folks to?
We have a couple training options going on April 30 in New Orleans. We have Michelle Jump from MedSec, who's going to be teaching more of the regulatory affairs side. So if you're a regulatory affairs professional and you want to know about cybersecurity, she's going to talk about how to stand up a cybersecurity program within an organization, whether it be a healthcare system or a medical device manufacturer, or maybe a vendor who's serving a medical device manufacturer or healthcare delivery organization. And it's very related to the Joint Security Plan, which was just released today from the Health Sector Coordinating Council, the HSCC. And that's a framework designed to help healthcare organizations stand up their own cybersecurity program so that they don't have to repeat all the mistakes that all of the rest of us have made, but can learn and follow a good template. So that's one of the courses, how to stand up a security program within a healthcare organization. And then the other training by Adam is going to be on threat modeling. So Adam Shostak, very well known for his book on threat modeling, and he's been with us at Archimedes for before the pandemic, actually.
Been a guest on Conversing Labs as well.
Oh, terrific. He always has a good Star Wars joke.
He does. That's true. It's true.
He'll be teaching about how to do threat modeling and really, I think, bringing it down to earth so that you don't have to fear it. And I find that most professionals, whether they're engineers or product directors or risk managers or even executives or vice presidents who oversee somebody who's organizing cybersecurity, it really teaches them sort of how the thinking works. It's going to help them understand red flags of choices and threat models. So if a security director reports to you and they tell you something like, we've never been hacked, we don't need to worry, that's when the executive can say, no, I learned in Adam's class, that's not how it works. So he really brings it down to earth
through
hands-on exercises, makes it become tractable.
Yeah. He's got a great way of just simplifying and really focusing up what could be a very amorphous, scary conversation. When I look at healthcare and care environments, it seems like some of the trends that are influencing those and influencing cybersecurity are trends that you see elsewhere as well, like the digital transformation, the increasing reliance on cloud-based systems and hosted applications, just the incredible influx of smart and connected devices that 20 years ago or 30 years ago were, even if they were electronic, probably weren't internet connected. Right. Amazing new capabilities and definitely want to own them. And yet sometimes difficult to appreciate the additional risk that comes along with that. And in some ways we see that with this United case, right? Having all these healthcare organizations migrate to this one provider, great, until that provider goes down and you've got no backup. Do you see that dynamic playing out just within the healthcare organizations that you work with? And is there an easy solution to that problem of both taking advantage of kind of these amazing new capabilities, but also managing the cyber risk.
Like right, right. So I would recharacterize this as, how do we manage the risk as we're moving from the old world of on-prem software to cloud services? And let me be the first or second to say, I think the cloud is great. The cloud can do great things, but you have to do it with the OT cybersecurity lens. If you take the IT cybersecurity lens, you're likely going to shoot yourself in the foot. For instance, perimeter-based thinking, that's very quaint. That's very 1990s. Firewalls can be useful to reduce risk, but if your security system depends upon an adversary not getting through a firewall or not getting access to some resource, then I would say that's a very perimeter-based thinking, and it is not resilient.
Right.
Resilience means if an adversary breaks in, you don't have these catastrophic system-wide failures, or you don't have to take down the whole system. You might have a partial failure or a small part, or maybe a small geography would be temporarily down, but not the whole country. And so I think if we can get some of the OT cybersecurity thinking into the cloud services for healthcare delivery, then we're going to be able to better manage these risks. And that's why at Archimedes, we have executives coming to speak with our attendees from Google Cloud, as well as Amazon Web Services for the life sciences. And they're going to talk about how medical device manufacturers and health information technology providers use their services. And it's going to be open floor to ask questions about how do you manage risk when it's healthcare specific rather than just accessing your email, right? Because it's very different. If somebody's breaking into your email, three tries on a password, you get locked out, that's okay. But if you have a pacemaker and mistype a password three times, you probably don't want to lock out a clinician. It's not the right approach. But the cloud is already being used for many things, from health information technology to radiology. But we did see an incident similar to Change Healthcare, but at a smaller scale, when ransomware infected a radiation therapy manufacturer. This was years ago, in fact.
Yep.
And they did the exact same thing as Change Healthcare. They took down their cloud. But when they did that, suddenly, for several weeks, none of the cancer radiation therapy devices that depended on that cloud could function. The dosimetry was stored in the cloud. And so it's okay to use the cloud, but we have to design it to manage that risk and understanding the product should still work, maybe in some kind of degraded form if the cloud becomes unavailable.
And these are conversations that need to happen really at the very earliest stages of product design, or maybe if the product's already designed, do you need to be kind of reframing this? Do you see medical device makers doing that? For example, products these days might have red teaming or other forms of, like, let's put on an adversary's hat and look at this device and think through different scenarios and then figure out how we address those. Is that becoming commonplace, or is that more the exception than the rule these days with medical device makers?
I would say it's becoming more common only because it's written into the guidance documents and it's expected that you have penetration testing, for instance, which is a form of the red teaming. You'll find in some of the guidance documents, it says when you do this red teaming or the penetration testing of your product, make sure the people doing that are not the same as the design team. A lot of people make this mistake without realizing, of course, you think your system's secure because you designed it. You need to get a different set of people who have different biases, different ways of thinking. You want someone such that the designers react, well, wait, that's not fair. You're not allowed to do that. That's when the red team
is effective.
Yeah.
And in fact, next month on the UC San Francisco Stanford CIRSE seminar series that I host, I'll be hosting David Brumley, who will be talking about red teaming, designer analysis, and things of that nature.
Do you have time for two more questions?
Sure.
Okay. So you worked for a while within the FDA as their acting director for medical device cybersecurity. I'm interested in that experience, what you took away from it, and how that's influenced you.
I would go back to work for FDA anytime, redo that experience. Not only was it a great learning experience, I also felt like I was able to make contributions. And my successor is running a great team, which is now an entire division of medical device cybersecurity that was just announced a couple weeks ago. And they have a great team that's forming. I would say people talk about government dysfunction. The group I was in, they were stellar. And I continue to just be so impressed with every individual, with every leader, and how they explain their thinking and how they're so thoughtful. And I can't say that's normal, right? Most organizations don't have a good way of bringing up sort of new leaders. And so it was just so wonderful to be able to interact with great role models for just really good leadership, especially when they need to convey news that somebody doesn't want to hear negative information. I really appreciate their approach. I certainly learned a lot. For instance, how a bill becomes a law, Schoolhouse Rock. It's a little bit different when you're in government.
I'm just a bill.
Let's sing along, kids. But there's a whole other set of processes through good old OMB, Circular A19, I believe, for how you can work with Congress to create legislation with the consent of the full executive branch. And that's not something you learn in school. Today, I encourage students to take internships at the FDA, especially computer science students or regulatory affairs students who maybe like computing, but maybe don't want to spend their entire careers just programming, right? So if you understand computing and you want to be motivated by helping people, go work for the FDA. They're a great employer and great people.
And they actually can affect change. That is something that I think in other federal agencies, it might be harder for people working there to see how we really making things change. The FDA really can.
Yes, I can't agree more. And I'm just glad we have what I think are the right people in the right roles for medical device security at FDA. It didn't have to be this way.
Yeah.
Because they're not all government offices are, shall we say, functional.
Yeah.
But I'm quite pleased that FDA has been able to retain such great talent and also export talent. There are people who leave the agency, go to the private sector, and continue to do great things in medical device security.
One of the things that we write a lot about here at Reversing Labs is threats to software supply chain. We've obviously seen those with SolarWinds and 3CX and MoveIt and so forth. We talked a little bit about software bills of materials. Are both device makers and end user organizations, are they attuned to this risk, particularly as regards their use of things like open source software, but also commercial software? They've got long software supply chains, just like everybody else does. Is this something that has hit home in the medical device field, to the best of your knowledge, or not as much?
I think on the medical device manufacturing side, it is now law you must submit an SBOM. It's not, do you feel like it? Is it a good idea? You simply have to. FDA is not even allowed to say don't. They're required to require an SBOM because of the law. So I think every manufacturer, if they don't already know, they probably need to hire a different consulting group or regulatory affairs person because this is law. It's been around for over a year.
Do you sense that it's changing practices is the more meaty question there? Yes. Okay. We can comply with this. It's like any other compliance conversation, right? Like you can comply with the law, but is it actually having downstream effects within your organization in terms of how you make stuff?
So there's checkbox compliance, and then there's actual cybersecurity. So the SBOM, in some sense, you have to checkbox the SBOM. But while you're doing that, you're likely going to be learning a lot about risks you didn't realize you were taking. Or they're going to be at the system engineering level as systems are being integrated. You're going to realize that some of these risks become actually existential to the entire system. Imagine like Change Healthcare, when you don't realize how much you depend upon certain pieces of software. So one of the benefits of an SBOM is you're going to be much more quickly able to identify and answer the question, am I vulnerable to that new zero day? Right now, you might run around with your head chopped off like a chicken, right? Just saying, oh my God, OpenSSL, do I run that version? Log4j and all that. SBOM should help on that for manufacturers to much more quickly, for instance, tell the FDA, don't worry, we don't use that version. Or, oops, we do use that version. Here's our mitigation plan. But don't worry, because we already have a plan if one of our software packages gets compromised. Here are the steps. And then for the healthcare delivery organization, they're not required to ingest the SBOM, but it's certainly a very valuable piece of evidence, so valuable to just know what's at risk. So if you're trying to convince your cyber insurance provider that you're doing a good job, your SBOMs can help you there, because you're going to know more about what risks you're taking. And I know some of the more sophisticated healthcare systems have learned how to use SBOMs in their procurement stage, such that they can really push back on a manufacturer where the sales engineer says, don't worry, we're going to provide you updates. And then later you say, wait, you're shipping me Windows 10 and that ends in 1 year. So what are you going to do after that? Oh, so the SBOM really keeps people honest if used appropriately.
It gives you a stage on which to have what might be difficult conversations or conversations that previously you might have only had in the wake of some adverse incident, right? Well, wait, that was running Windows 10. Why didn't you tell us? Which is good. That's a pleasant thought. Which leads me to my final question, which is medical device cybersecurity is really at the forefront of what the federal government is doing in regard to trying to improve cyber resilience and set down some really clear guidelines for manufacturers and vendors to follow with regard to cybersecurity. I guess I'd ask you, what lessons have we learned from what has happened thus far and the kind of the response we've seen that might be applicable to other sectors, other industries, either critical infrastructure, other critical infrastructure sectors, or just more general in terms of what's working, what isn't working?
I have a feeling not too many of your listeners are from oil, gas, and water. But if they are, come to our next live podcast that's actually happening in just half an hour. They're going to be talking about all 16 of the CISA-defined critical sectors for cybersecurity, not just healthcare. Healthcare is only one of the 16. And although we have a lot of problems to solve in healthcare cybersecurity, I think we are at least asking a lot of the right questions. We're getting a lot of the right people in the room. We understand what a lot of the problems are. That's not true for all sectors. So there's still a lot of places where a threat model, they might not even know what that is. OT, cybersecurity, is still a foreign term in many different sectors. And I think one of the things that other sectors can learn is how to stand up these communities. So the Health Sector Coordinating Council is a great example. They are the designated assembly place for the healthcare sector for writing shared knowledge frameworks. How do you stand up a security program and organization? HSCC has a document catering to healthcare. We don't yet see that universally in all 16 sectors, but those are some things I think they might not be able to just cut and paste, but they can learn from what are some of the effective techniques to get people together to solve the risks that are specific to their sector.
Kevin Fu of Northeastern University and the Archimedes Center, thank you so much for coming on and speaking to us on the Conversing Labs podcast. It was a pleasure. And I would inform our attendees that you're about to step into another meeting on fortifying cyber physical resilience. People might want to tune into that as well. But thank you so much for doing a preview here on Conversing Labs. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, you're welcome, Paul. Great to be on the program. Thanks for your questions.
Yep. Always a pleasure. And we'll do it again, Kevin.
Of course. I wish you high availability.
Thank you. Same to you.